this is a seven-part series. If we get through seven parts, we'll get through seven parts. If we stop along the way, that's quite all right. In the first part, I've made an introductory statement. The second part is I'm entitled The Context of Energy Policy, and we had gotten partway on the national context of energy policy, and I want to finish that section this morning. The third part will be on the theological foundations for energy, Christian energy policy, or perspective, and I hope to get into that today. And beyond that will be the criteria or the guidelines out of religious faith and the problems for looking at energy policy. The next section will be a look at energy options. I take some time to give you an overview of some of the major possibilities in the area and some of the policy options which we have to face. And then concluding two sections will be on the church's responsibility and personal responsibility in the energy. So a seven-section series here. Okay, we're in the second section, which is the section on context. And I had talked about the national context and had mentioned several areas: America's identity crisis, the political system, the sectional differences, national security, the energy industry, and I concluded with certain trade-offs. There are many more trade-offs, but I hoped that a few that I mentioned give you some idea that in this field it's not working the ideal, the good guys and the bad versus the bad guys, but often it's a matter of some compromise and trade-offs between two things that we may both want to have, but that are not compatible in all points of policy. Okay, the next section then is the international context. And I have two sections under this. The first is a characterization of the international context as one of interrelationship and instability. There are two kinds of interdependencies or interrelationships in an international context. One is the equal but competing partners. And by that I mean countries such as the United States, Japan, Western Europe. These countries are roughly equal in economic power. And deal with each other on a fairly equal basis. And indeed, the percentage of commerce throughout the world is, the greater percentage of it is between these sorts of nations. On the other hand, there's the interdependence of something I would call the master and the slave. This is an interdependence which I think characterizes, again, I'm not going to say we're master and they're slave or anything like this, but it's a form of interdependence, which is not a very beautiful form of interdependence, of power and weakness, in which one side dictates and the other side receives, and it's the relationship that adheres between the master and the slave. It can be a very beautiful relationship sometimes, but it's still an exploitive relationship, and one which is not ethically defensible. Now, the first kind of interdependence, the one between equals, is threatened. Is unstable at this point because of the scarcity of resources. When we're talking about energy policy, we have to be aware that many countries are competing for scarce energy sources, and the competition now is in terms of price, but that competition can take the form of war very quickly as events in the Near East are constantly threatening. On the other hand, the interdependence between rich and poor is ethically indefensible and threatens to, in many areas, erupt in armed conflict as the poor seek to right the balance, so to speak, right the balance of justice and seek to get their place in the sun. A third element, besides those two elements of instabilities because of interdependencies, comes from the threat of nuclear proliferation, which, in part, I would say, is encouraged by the export of nuclear energy. That's how proliferation of course, gets into the energy question. Some people think that the availability of plutonium from the nuclear reaction will lead to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Other people are not so worried about that, thinking that that material is probably available through other sources. Okay, so the international context is one of interrelationship and instability. The second part, maybe we can do it a little bit more in terms of discussion here, has to do with what I'm calling the population growth and the quest for basic economic security. I'm wondering if anyone here knows what the population of the world is at this point. Does anybody know? There we go. Say it loud.
4.5 billion
people. What's the growth rate? 200 billion. We would be elbow to elbow. Let me tell you, there would be people living in Cloudy Pass, trying to scrape out a living for the soil. What's the growth rate? Does anyone know what the growth rate of world population is? Fast. What do you mean by fast? 1.7% per year. Well, that's down from 2% just about 10 years ago, which is some very helpful sign, hopeful signs in terms of population growth. 1.7%, 1.6, 1.7. How long does it take a population growing at a rate of 1.7% to double? Does anyone know? There's an old rule called the rule of 70. Divide the percentage rate into 70 and you get how long it takes to double. About 40 years. So at present growth rates of 1.7%, population will double every 40 years. Most of that population growth is taking place in underdeveloped countries. Why, let me ask another question, why is it that population growth rates are so high in underdeveloped countries and are fairly low? In almost all developed countries, the population growth is coming down to replacement level. Very, you know, in this country, we were down to a point of only 2.06 or 7 children per family, and it's 2.11 for replacement level. But I think we're back up over that again, which would mean that we would be at a stable population in about 20, 30 years. It takes a little while because of population dynamics for that kind of thing to work through. Population, in other words, does not slow down until about 20, 30, or 40 years after you get a exact replacement level number of children. But the question is, why is population growth so fast in the third world? Why don't those people realize that they're going to starve themselves to death? That's a frequent question asked by people in the United States. Does anyone know the response to that? She's read from the world. He's been studying this stuff. Yeah, that's essentially correct. The reason why there's high growth rates of population is that, first of all, is that health measures have decreased the death rate, and the birth rate has not gone down as quickly. There was a great population surge in the West, of course, too, at the beginning of industrialization, but it was not quite as bad as this because health techniques weren't quite as good. Now, the reason why birth rates stay up is precisely for the reason that she has said, which is the matter of economic security. They're not calculating what the population of the world is going to be 20 years or 30 years or 50 years. They're calculating how they're going to exist when they get to be 50 and 60 years old. And if you calculate any kind of rational calculation, under normal circumstances, it takes 6 children to produce 1 male offspring to care for you in your old age. Children also provide, at a very early age, for their own economic, they provide their own food, in a sense, because they can work, and many times they indeed relieve the burdens of work. There are, in essence, 3 or 4 or 5 good reasons why it's rationally smart for people in very poor, impoverished conditions to have many children. And they're not very expensive either, because you don't have to worry about mass education and things like that. So they are an economic benefit at the same time that they're not much of a burden. It doesn't cost you much. Where the reverse of that is true in our society. They cost a lot to raise children, and they do not provide any economic support, but in fact they're an economic drain to families. Yeah.
And less people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it has something to do with provision of basic economic security and the whole mode in which we work. And so it's very characteristic of every culture that's gone through what's called the economic transition into modernization has, as a matter of course, without the provision of birth control or any kind of propaganda, lowered its birth rate. So it has much more to do with economics and economic security than it does with the availability of birth control materials and the efforts of government. The efforts of government, as India has, in some places, they were trying to get compulsory sterilization and giving people radios for being sterilized. None of that worked, basically, because... Oh, seriously. That's one of the reasons Indira Gandhi lost the election a few years ago, is because of the stringent birth control policies, which were resisted because people understood that economically that was foolishness to not have lots of children. Well, the solution would seem to be, and this is a contextual item, would be to industrialize the third world. There are some drawbacks to that, of course. One is that there's no hope, it seems to me, that the Third World can industrialize like we have, because the drain on resources and the pollution would be just too great. I don't think the world's resources would sustain any kind of operation like that. And second, I would think that the Third World countries would have to think about whether industrialization or modernization along Western lines, energy and capital intensive, is desirable in the first place. I would think that some of us are becoming to be aware, at least those of you who are reading Wendell Berry's book, that there have been certain costs, certain social costs, certain ideological costs to the whole process of industrialization. But in any case, whether or not the Third World chooses to industrialize along Western lines, which I'm not going to say speak for them, but I would certainly raise questions about that. Regardless of whether they do or don't, the provision of basic economic security for people living under poor and malnourished circumstances is an absolute essential. It is absolutely essential ethically, because it's a matter of justice and concern for the poor, which comes out of Christianity. But it seems also that it's an economic necessity, because for just the very lives of these people. And in some respects, it is we who contribute to some degree to the impoverishment and malnourishment of people in the Third World. Does anyone know how Americans contribute to the conditions that lead to impoverishment and malnourishment in the Third World? What are the ways in which Americans do that? How does that work? In Guatemala, some of the prime agricultural land is used for the production of beef, cheap beef, which goes into McDonald's hamburgers and other places, while people who are hungry or living right in the vicinity, where that beef is grown. Here and there, all over the place, the same sort of thing exists. Some of the best agricultural land, Dominican Republic with sugarcane, cocoa and coffee and other export items in various South American countries. And what we gain is cheaper foodstuffs. And the cost is the impoverishment and the marginalization of people in Latin America. Now, if we stop consuming all that, it doesn't mean that the conditions would change, because what adheres in most of those countries is a split between rich and poor, which is even worse than the split between rich and poor in this country. And what you have is a small landowning and increasingly industrial middle class who garnered the benefits of export crops and industrialization and economic growth, and an increasingly large number of very poor people who have received none of the benefits of that industrialization or the export crops, or very few of them. In some cases, they get wages for living in the field, but perhaps they would be better off having the land where they could grow their own crops for their own food, because the wages don't allow them to produce much food. The conclusion of this contextual item is to say this, that to attain basic economic security, that people in the Third World need to have certain things either provided or certain conditions have to be met first. And one of these, and there's four of them, first, there must be some provision of economic opportunity. I don't mean necessarily economic opportunity in factories, but some attempt to allow these people to have a productive farm. Maybe it's only a few acres. Particularly big has been a push towards what's called agrarian reform, which is land reform plus the provision of certain economic services. Just because you have land reform, that is redistribution of land from, say, large wealthy landowners to the peasants who are tenants or marginalized people living on the edge of the fields, just because you have this reform, unless you provide some sort of economic basis, such as credit arrangements, a place to market their products, irrigation facilities, what happens in most countries without these backup items, economic foundation items, is often the re-centralization of the land. Mexico had a fairly good land reform in the 30s and 40s, but the conditions in Mexico are pretty much back to where they were. So land reform plus the provision of certain economic security in the forms of banking services and so forth is a important criteria to allow people to then grow their own food, sell it, and consume off their plots, and therefore have some sort of economic security. So some sort of economic basis is the first criteria. Secondly, governments themselves must place a high priority on agricultural reform. And that's both our government and the governments in third world countries. A few countries, this is really has been the case. Tanzania is one, I think even Cuba to some degree. But an effort to what Joseph Collins and Francis Moore LePay have said, food first, a policy in which food and economic security for the poorest people becomes the first priority of governments. At present, that is not the priority in most countries. Many countries, Brazil would be a classic example, have put economic growth along the capital and energy-intensive lines of the United States as a first priority, and the main beneficiaries of that have been, of course, a small and increasingly large middle class. And the theory has been that by getting that group modernized, that there will be a trickle-down effect to the poorest. Well, the trickle has not reached the bottom yet, and there are many people who think that never will. So a policy which reverses this from a trickle-down theory to one of food first, or the provision of economic security to the bottom people first, is a second, what we call a without which nothing will happen kind of thing. The third is that industrialized countries, such as the United States, but not us alone, must stop practices, forms of aid, and investments which worsen the condition of the poor. Now that's going to be very difficult because we provide aid through public means and government, and that at least is open to some change, but a large part of our relationships with third world countries comes from large corporations. And I'm not here to whip around the large corporations. A lot of people want to do that. But I think that we just have to face the fact that large corporations are who they are. They have certain dynamics, and many of those dynamics are not compatible with provision of food first or the provision of economic security to people in the third world. Often these large corporations provide technical knowledge and certain technologies. Often these are beyond the capacity of people in the field to either comprehend or to purchase because they're poor. And the third world and the multinationals are really in for making a profit and for providing a certain kind of service. And the recipient of that service, or the people they feel they're serving, are often people in the industrialized countries. And so given the dynamics of the capitalistic system, which seeks to reduce costs and to then sell at a reasonable price and make a profit, this is the dynamics of the organization, and there are very humble, good Christians working in these organizations, and they are following a certain dynamic which is not always compatible with the third world needs. Somehow, and I'm not quite sure how it is, some sort of reversal of the habits of these large organizations, and I suspect that the reversal will come when people in the third world finally throw them out. But in the meantime, there are certain practices of these organizations which are not compatible. In fact, increase the impoverishment and the malnourishment of people. I think that's partly it. There's also a lot of self-justification going on among them, that they are providing services. In many cases, they're invited in by the governments of those countries to provide services. Of course, the leaders of the country, of course, come from that elite class who are more like us than the poor people in their own countries. And they feel that they are providing jobs, which they are. The tourist industry in the Dominican Republic provides a lot of jobs for busboys and crap table operators and charwomen and so forth. And so they justify their existence in many cases because they do and create certain level of jobs. Of course, they create other places, they create poverty as well. So you're right, that's an individual ethic that we often pursue.
Well, that's been the American kind of corporate.
And there's also a sense in which we, there are certain limitations of getting on beyond a certain level of nationalism. We kind of look at our country first, and we try to do, international politics really works on a kind of self-interested motive, and most people don't transcend that kind of self-interested.
But we do within our country, too.
Oh, yeah, I see that. But
we have the poor in our country.
That's right, that's
that
right.
Have that same problem that the corporation does not understand.
But we probably allow certain activities in third world countries that we wouldn't even allow in this country. For example, I can't cite any examples. Maybe some of you know some examples. But certain things like DDT, we've outlawed for use in this country, but we haven't outlawed for shipping overseas. Several toxic wastes we will not allow to be used in this country, but we have not ruled out the possibility of export because we don't want to hurt those companies who have these large supplies. So the companies exhaust their supplies at least by shipping these things to the third world.
Medicine is the same way. Mm-hmm. The things that, of course, we would no way, they have to have certain labels on here that if you're pregnant, if you have certain allergies or whatever, do not touch this. And the only thing that it would say in a third world country made by the same company here would be, do not take if you're prone to heart attacks and things like that when there's quite a few other things on it too.
Well, this gives you some idea of the context in which we're doing energy policy. Energy is required by these people. I'm not sure it's a capital or energy intensive kind of energy. Maybe it's the provision of very simple forms of energy on capital. The international relations are characterized by a certain instability and poverty to which we contribute. I don't want to, because we cite all these items, by the way, I don't want to get the impression that we're the sole perpetrator of great evils on the third world. Many of those people visit those things on themselves, but we do contribute. Okay, so that's the international context of energy policy. And to get ahead of myself a little bit, I would say that ethically, the call is for us to reduce our consumption of energy so that the poor people in the third world can increase their energy consumption. Because even the provision of basic economic security, which is not just big capital plants and American large technology, will require some increase of consumption of energy. And if there are shortages of energy, of scarce energy sources, then we will have to cut back so that other people may increase their consumption of energy. For example, the rising price of oil has been devastating to third world countries. Plans for development, even good plans for development in third world countries, not just the kind that leads to the marginalization of people, have been frustrated by the rise in the price of oil since 1972. Development plans, even effective ones, have been thrown on the rocks because they cannot afford the basic energy to it is a renewable resource, but it can be overexploited. If you use it up faster than it grows, then you, of course, it's not renewable over the long run. In certain areas of the world, there's devastating consequences of this. In the foothills of the Himalayas and Nepal, there has been a rapid depletion of forests for firewood, and the conditions that result from that in terms of floods and the loss of soil are dramatic. You wanted to add something?
No, I just read that in the book.
Oh, yeah. That's been a particularly good example. Eric Ekholm of the World Watch Institute has written a long paper on the wood crisis in the world. Places like Railroad Creek, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true, because I suspect that the Holden Village can heat itself on wood and not deplete these resources, particularly around here. I'm not sure. But, I would think that here would be one place where wood, the burning of wood, at least for the short term, would be a smart thing to do, rather than use up finite oil resources. Oil's a very nice fuel, by the way. It's a dilemma.
Yeah.
Number one, on the one hand, to be effective in this area of energy, or concern for people in the third world, you need to know a hell of a lot.
You do.
And in the process of learning a hell of a lot, or dealing with this material, on the other hand, you get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
The enemy is Chase Manhattan Bank and Ford Motor.
Or it's or you become very to deal with it. Another way of dealing with the overwhelmingness of it is to find devil figures. That makes simplifies it. If you can say that the problem is Ford Motor Company or Chase Manhattan,
yeah,
then it simplifies the problem, and you've got an enemy. Where, from my studies of this material, the enemy is terribly amorphous and hard to find. It's in the structures of things, and in the unintended consequences of people who are here with their left hand doing one thing with good purpose, and they have self-respect for what they're doing, and with the effect unintended is to create poverty and malnourishment. It's a terribly insidious thing because, on the one hand, they're not going to change their behavior because they feel it's good. On the other hand, you get the effects of this. And it's to locate evil in this place or that place does not really handle the complexity of the situation. But how then do you work with the overwhelmingness and the disengagement, the sense of I want to disengage or be apathetic in the face of this? I think one of the clues is community. And when I get to the theological section, I want to talk about the community of God, the kingdom of God, as pointing to a new level of community, and talk about the norm of participation, one of the important elements, it seems to me. I'm going to talk about justice, sustainability, and participation. And a more communal promoting forms of technology. It seems to me that we're going to continue to have this kind of schizophrenic reaction of intense kind of idealism and action and disengagement and apathy on the other side. Unless you, if you approach this individualistically, that's what's going to happen. And I guess if you approach it with the idea that you're going to solve the problems of the world, salvation by grace alone becomes a very important criteria. Reinhold Niebuhr used to say the only person who becomes disillusioned is the one who has illusions to begin with. If you don't enter this field with illusions about what you can do and about your ability to handle it, then the sense of apathy and disengagement doesn't become so strong, I think.
If all this heightens our understanding of sin.
And the cross, yes. Yeah. I think this is the element of theology of the cross.
It gives some clarity of Paul's talking about principalities and powers.
Powers, sure does.
You know, he said, you use the word structures. With the left hand, we do something good. With the right hand, we're getting rich.
Mm-hmm. Or creating...
Or there's all this mixed stuff going on, and it's in some ways bigger than it is even manageable.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of principalities and powers.
One of the really troublesome aspects of our modern life, it seems to me, though, is the increasing complexity and increase in scale, increase in size of things, which tend to create that sense of apathy. That's the direction of modern technological systems. The very nature of the systems require a certain size and specialization of management and the ability to organize very diverse and specialized things, but that requires a fairly large, wealthy organization to accomplish. And the direction that we seem to be heading in many, many areas is this kind of increase in scale and complexity, which overwhelms us. And I'm not quite sure how we deal with that or get away from it. One way is to go to Holden, but I'm not sure that that's any way in the long range to handle it. But something to do with community, it seems to me, is some sort of key. Well, that got me through one item of the context. Took me half an hour to do that. But I hope you realize that there are these international elements which frustrate the development of an ethically and an efficient sort of energy policy.
In some ways, isn't this all very new? I mean, there's been such a quick growth of global kind of interrelationships and so on, the development of corporate power, that because we went so far ahead in technology without understanding our responsibilities and the use of it, that now we're caught in that lag between something that's going ahead and we somehow have to stop and find out how we use it responsibly.
We have had a race of people that has grown up in a very low technological profile, and all of a sudden we have attained this great power through science and mechanics that are through the use of chemistry and so many things, that we really have not come of age in the sense of how to use it. Or what its implications are for human organization, human community. And I think that's going to take several generations to work out, if it's ever worked out.
We have a frontier mentality that we just can go ahead and there's you can have links because you can always move on to the next
I think that's changing quickly. I'm a little bit worried still about the questions of scale and complexity, which we haven't even begun to deal with. Waste in some degree, for example, the slag heap over here or this tailings pile wouldn't probably be present in today's mining operations. They wouldn't allow it. That's an advance, but I'm not sure we have even begun to deal with questions of complexity and scale in terms of their effect on individuals and small communities and what we need as individuals to feel whole in a very big and complex world. Even the community, 200 years ago, you couldn't even think beyond your own village because you didn't know what was going on and had no way of finding out what was going on, except for maybe 8 or 10 months later. Wars would go on. The Battle of New Orleans was fought in 1812, 6 weeks after the war. This truce had been signed because they hadn't gotten the word. Or was it 2 or 3 weeks because they hadn't gotten the word the war was over? Andy Jackson was a hero after the war was over.
I can think of just in regards to the church, where I remember when I was a kid, when pastors didn't make it, we shipped them to Canada. I mean, we didn't think about the Canadians, but that was just the route. If they were a problem, we got rid of them.
Instead of the Canada.
You know, and we didn't think globally. We just didn't think globally.
Now when our kids don't make it, we ship them to Holden, right?
Yeah. How about Mother's Day?
Okay. The next context, the third contextual item, is what I'm calling the biosphere. I'm not using the environment or the ecology, but the word biosphere, meaning all of life, human life and natural life, nature together. And here I merely want to make a point. Most of you are at least familiar with that. You probably wouldn't be here unless you were. And probably since you've been here, have learned a lot about the care of nature because this place really lends itself to the consideration of those sorts of things. Very basically, the interrelationships that humans have extend beyond just human beings, but into a kind of a larger setting, which is the vast web of life and life support system. And it's those which provide the basis of the foundation for life at all. There's no such thing as a human community without the basics of food and fuel and shelter that only the natural support systems can provide. And here the word that I think we need to hear is one of limits, a basic kind of presuppositions to our energy policy, that there are limitations with regard to the biosphere. There's limits to the human consumption of energy. I think there are limits not just of sources of energy, but human beings' capabilities to handle increasing amounts of energy. But second, there are limits to the supply of energy. Some people think that with solar and maybe the harnessing of fusion that we have unlimited energy supply, but I don't think there are many people who believe that anymore. Even with the availability of large supplies, we are going to run up against certain problems of heat, of heating the atmosphere with the use of energy and so forth. So there are limits to the supply of energy. And finally, there's limits to the capacity of ecological systems to absorb waste. I think that's obvious enough. If you overload a stream, you're going to kill all the fish. If you overload the atmosphere, you're going to kill a lot of people. Different ecological systems have different thresholds. Some webs, some systems have vulnerable links that if you break, you'll eventually destroy the whole system. But in any case, there are limits to the capacity of these systems to absorb waste. And unless we become aware of that and take it as a presupposition of our energy policy, we're going to have a lot of difficulty. There are also one other kind of limit, which I think that we have failed to recognize. We have a kind of Promethean spirit, or as Norma said, a frontier mentality. We have thought that there is a unlimited capacity of human beings to think and to organize and to manage the things that we produce or make. Well, I would suggest that there are social limits, one which we have not considered fully yet, social limits to our ability to consume and to expand and to manage complex technological systems. This social limits comes out in such things as the side effects. I don't know if any of you have read some of the material of Barry Commoner, but his book, The Closing Circle, it was a popular book about 10 years ago or maybe more recently than that, where he pointed out it's the side effects and the of modern technology which have caused pollution, not economic growth or the increase in people, but the tunnel vision is the base of it, the tunnel vision of modern technology, in that we conceive modern technologies along a narrow spectrum. We say that we'll devise and implement this technology in order to accomplish this. We use the car to increase the mobility of people. What we fail to do is to take into the full ramifications, the side effects of the automobile in terms of life patterns, in terms of air pollution, in terms of the consumption of energy. And so that there are so many ramifications to each new technology that there are perhaps social limits to either foresee or to manage these side effects. And with increasing complexity and scale, there may even be limits to the ability of us to manage these large systems. With the increase in the use of computers, maybe that's not true. Certainly computerization of much of the financial aspects of large organizations has given some greater degree of control, but whether that has unlimited, whether we have an unlimited capacity, I'm not quite sure. Now, with this becomes important, these social limits, because our technologies impact natural systems, and the unpredictable side effects sometimes are worse than the benefits that we get from a technology. Unfortunately, often the benefits go to some people and the side effects go to other folks, so that there is a conflict set up between the people who get benefits and those who have to bear the cost. And of course, the people who have the benefit want to continue to receive the benefit, and the ones who receive the cost want to get those folks off their back. Well, anyway, one could conclude this section on the biosphere by saying that the condition of future human life in the biosphere also become a human responsibility as we increasingly employ technological systems. And now this has relevance for energy, because energy employs technological systems. And that leads us to the second last of the contextual elements, and that's what I want to call the technological context. We've talked about this already some. And the first element here would be to say that constantly evolving technological mix shifts priorities and trade-offs. To make energy policy or to think of a coherent path for the future has to deal with the fact that daily we have the development of new technologies and systems which change the nature of the policy, either change the policy itself or change the options available to us. This is a fast-changing mix, so that it becomes difficult for someone trying to feel their way through this mess to say what would be the best policy when tomorrow the policy changes. The second element of the technological context is something that I mentioned the other day, and which in past and has been an implication of what we've been saying this morning, is that technological choices are social and ethical choices. Again, when Barry Commoner talks about tunnel vision, we usually think of our technologies having to do with our technologies. But if we decide to elect nuclear technology, for example, we are electing a large-scale technology that needs a lot of protection. We will need to pay people to run that, to build it, to maintain it. Those people will demand a certain amount of status and monetary reward, which will follow the status, and their values will tend to become the values of the society. That which where we place our resources and our energies tends to be the area that becomes the dynamic element in the society and sets the pattern in terms of values. I think that Marx's notion that here apply in that the way you organize your technologies has an important bearing. Marx might say a deterministic bearing. But I would think it would certainly have a heavy influence on who you are as a people, the values that you hold. If you elect large-scale energy systems, you're going to elect a system that needs high levels of achievement along technical lines, certain values such as pragmatism, a certain definition of success, a heavy scientific and technological orientation, a materialistic way of life. I think all these things go with the technologies that you elect. And unless we see those ramifications, we're in deep trouble.
Wendell Berry is offering a different, as a model for our life.
And you'll get a different value system
right.
If you do that.
Yeah.
And that's entirely correct. One does not have to say that technologies determine values. That's the kind of the Marxian perspective. Most of you are familiar with that. Marx's position was that history changes with the evolution of technology. And values change as a kind of, they're the tail on the dog of the way we organize our productive life, in the essence, our technological systems. And so that we have a certain set of values in this society has to do with the way we organize our technical and our productive lives. Man is fusser is. Man is what he eats. And if you eat a certain kind of technology, you're going to be, to some degree, that way. That does not mean that ideas have no influence on the way we are, because we really, in a sense, I think, elect. Important issue. Again, the question would be that in making our technological and productive choices, we may be determining our ethics and values, too. That's a long debate, which is healthy. I think we're experiencing, in parts of our society, a reaction against the values which have been associated with modern technology. Well, maybe we'll come to some sort of synthesis. Okay, I think I've hammered that home enough, though, this business about we, in effect, choose our futures and our choice of energy technologies today. And I think that's a profound statement about where we are. And we don't, I don't think our national leaders really appreciate that fact sufficiently. And if you listen to policy discussions, very seldom is that point even at the periphery of awareness. We argue at what costs the most, well, what's liable to provide the most amount of energy for the cheapest cost, and these other ramifications are simply not factored in. And I can understand the plight of the policymaker, because if you factor in these elements, it complicates the matter by a factor of 10, probably, rather than any kind of anything else. And I appreciate their overloadedness, too. You can simplify the number of variables that you have to work with, you simplify your life, and so they have.
It's hard to put ethics into a computer.
Oh, sure.
Spit out the answer.
As soon as you enter ethics, everybody has their own ideas too, and there's no way of quantifying that. Which, again,
you're on a commission with Presbyterians all over the United States, and
you
were talking about this tunnel vision thing from Barry Commoner. Automobiles were for travel, but the spin-offs were pollution and too many cars and all this energy problem, et cetera, et cetera. When you meet with these energy folks in the Presbyterian family, are you the one who brings up the tunnel vision thing?
Yeah, I just hammer home at that. That's my big bag.
Yeah.
That's my whole book's really about that kind of thing too. Is that that's my big feeling about the whole thing, is that we have this larger context that we don't see.
Well, the rest of the people sitting in the room that are discussing these things with you.
Some of them.
They're not dumb.
No, by no means.
Uh-uh.
Smarter than I am.
But they are.
And a lot of them know this.
Fatigued, maybe.
Well, we've gotten through two sections almost of this. The number of things that you have to consider, the fatigue of just being able to think through and utilize so many elements. It's just impossible. It's just difficult. But not impossible. I think we can. I hope I'm not leaving an impression by digging this hole awfully deep that things are impossible. I don't want to leave that impression at all. The third element of the technological context, briefly, is the concept of appropriate technology. Appropriate technology is a concept. I don't have time to spin it out thoroughly, but it's a concept which says that technology should be devised and implemented according to end use, that is to say, what job are you trying to accomplish? You don't need the chainsaw to cut butter I mentioned yesterday. A certain scale of things, so that complexity and size and hugeness of organization are not overwhelming. Certain comprehensibility to people, not just experts, but a comprehensibility of the people down who are in the pits trying to work with this material. One of the problems at Three Mile Island was the people who were running the systems probably didn't have sufficient training in the systems. We're not quite sure of that yet. it's a technology which does not overall create unemployment or marginalize people. And it's a type of technology that can be worked into a culture and a community without this totally disruptive kinds of impacts. In capital and energy intensive technologies, you know what I mean when I'm saying energy and capital intensive. I'm meaning the technologies that we often employ in this country, which use large amounts of energy and employ large, sophisticated machinery, plant, and equipment, and require large organizations to manage and to implement. That's what I'm calling by capital and energy intensive technology. I'm suggesting that this is often inappropriate in the third world context particularly, but even in our context. It's often not matched to end use. It's often not affordable or beyond the capacity of poor people to employ or to comprehend. And the third element, which seems to me to be inappropriate in it, is that it's frequently non-participative. I'm not quite sure how I can participate in the development and implementation of a nuclear power plant, for example. It requires a certain centralization of decision-making, whereas on certain smaller-scale technologies, there is a more participative quality. I'm not going to throw out large-scale technologies because I think the concept of appropriateness is a very well-chosen word. It's not small technologies and it's not large technologies, but it's technologies which are devised to the needs that you have. You may need a large technological system to run a subway for a mass transit system for many, many people. A subway system is an extremely efficient, and it helps the people who need, well, I see a couple people who don't know.
If you live in New York, you don't respond.
No, that system is efficient, though. It works. It moves 7.5 million people in that city, and at a fairly reasonable expense. You need a large power plant to provide the power for that system, and the system has to be fairly complex. So it's appropriate technology, not small or large. Unfortunately, inappropriate technologies, large energy and capital-intensive technologies, are often seen as status symbols in this world. And one of the dilemmas that we face as Americans is, since we have control of many of the more sophisticated technologies, is that we are frequently requested to export those technologies to third world by people in the third world who control the governments of those countries. And we are now up against the dilemma on the one hand of saying these are inappropriate technologies, yet I want to later on say that the international system of deciding technology should be participative. And so when the leadership of a third world country comes in and we say, yes, we want you to be participative in making these decisions, and they decide on large-scale, capital-intensive, and energy-intensive technologies, what in the hell do you do? The dilemma of is who decides appropriateness becomes a very important political contextual element. Finally, the church context. And we're trying to decide what we as Christians in denominations or just as individual Christians are to do on these elements. We have to realize that people within the church probably hold the same views as those people on the outside, and you have a mixture of opinions. On this group that I'm working among the Presbyterians, there are four members from Louisiana and Texas, and two of them are executives of large oil companies, and they have a slightly different perspective than I have on things. Now, what do you do? And they're not bad guys. They're really honest, good people. They're more Christian than I am, I feel. I'll honestly say that. And I think there has to be a certain sensitivity to differing perspectives and even conscientiously held perspectives within the church. It may end up being a policy statement or a final statement which we don't agree with entirely, but somehow we have to really take into account these positions of other people and see them as human beings and not reduce them to some sort of intolerable evil person because they don't see our great insights about appropriate technology and the need for needs of certain people as we perceive them and so forth. I just add that note of context to understand the fact that within our churches we differ and have to take that into account. Well, I think I'll conclude. I think it's about 10. Is there Any questions before I'll get into theology on Monday, because I basically feel that we have to, when we talk about energy questions from the Christian context, we have to start at the level of faith. And so Mondays will be a theological section. I'm going to talk basic Christian theology. And then the next section would be on what we derive out of that basic Christian perspective in the way of guidelines for guiding us as we think about energy questions.